All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Give me one moment here. We're getting set up on the screen. Okay. We are live on GTV, Odyssey, and Speak Free Radio today. It's Tuesday, so it's the Speak Free Radio day. Therefore, this stream is going to be more podcast format, a little more audio-based rather than visual-based. Unfortunately, it seems like GTV is actually not working again. I don't know if this is specifically on my end or if this is for everybody. Let me just really quick check on another user, see if theirs is working. Nope, it seems to be the entirety of the website, so it's unfortunate. Okay, so yeah, we unfortunately are not on GTV again tonight, sadly. We're gonna have to use Odyssey and Speak Free Radio. If you guys want to just listen in, Speak Free Radio would be the way to do that. If you want to physically watch, you can do that on Odyssey. So you've got a little bit of options. Okay. Anyways, hope everybody had a good weekend. We're starting off the week. We weren't live yesterday. Obviously, we don't normally do any shows on Mondays. It's just not, I don't know, it's not a show-worthy day to me. We got JQR Code in here. Welcome, brother. Owie, hello, my friend. Ketzer, Speak Free Radio. We got Anna, Dissident Farmer, Bass Vlad. Over on the GTV, we got Sax, Order, and Urban. Welcome, guys. Welcome. And Robert, welcome, folks. Okay. I hope everybody can hear me all right over on Speak Free Radio. This is stream number two for Speak Free Radio. Again, so since we are on a more of a radio broadcast type of thing, I would like to stick to mostly just audio for today's stream. I actually have a clip I would like to play, but it's not really the audio is not, I mean, the visuals are not required. It's very much audio driven. So we're gonna play that a little bit. We'll talk about it. It's talking about philosophy. I'm sure most people in this chat room have already heard about this quite a few times, but we'll go a little bit deeper on it. So, okay, let me pull this up. Okay, before we get started, I just want to go over the schedule as usual. So obviously we're live today. Tomorrow we're going to be live at 6 p.m. Eastern with Napalm. I actually hope Napalm gets back to me because I picked a topic and he hasn't responded yet if he likes that or not. Let me message him again, actually, just to kind of see if I can get that fully set up over there. But we'll be going live at 6 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, provided he's still on board. I have a good topic. I don't want to say it yet because I don't even know if he's on board with it. It'll be an interesting one, a little bit of a deep dive, kind of. Holokov, brother, with the 100 library coins. Can we get the Romans in the chat for Holokov? Thank you, my friend. Thank you. He just says O slash. I appreciate that, brother. Let's see what we got here. Okay. As for the rest of the week, Thursday, I'll be going live at 4 p.m. Eastern. Nothing special on Thursday. I'm kind of still brainstorming on what exactly it is I would like to do. Saturday, I'm going to have my first ever debate stream. Tanitris, who, if you watch this show enough, you'll know him for sure. He's been on three or four times now, I think. So Tanitris and I will be live at 4 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be doing a debate. He has confirmed, so I guess I can tell you guys the debate topic. I think I told you last time, actually. I'll say it again. We're going to be debating American culture. If we are for it, against it, what we think about it. One of us has stance A and the other has stance B, and we're going to debate this. We've never discussed this, so it's going to be a fully organic discussion. No notes are going to be taken or any kind of like pre-prepping. We're just going to hop into it, express our individual thoughts. And the main purpose of the show is, well, one is obviously we want to discuss this topic and kind of hopefully come to a mutual conclusion with it. But additionally, we want to show people how to actually sit, have a debate, have a conversation with each other in which they disagree on something without it turning into a vitriolic argument or some kind of a serious fight where, you know, there creates this, like, divide where we kind of break off our acquaintanceship or our friendship because of it. So it's a very big problem we have both within our movement and within the greater vast amounts of society. People do not know how to disagree on things and still get along, right? Everything becomes quite polarized for a lot of people. So then we got Sunday on the schedule. That's the final day of the week, and we don't have anything special planned for that. We're actually to be determined on Sunday. I don't know if I'm going to stream or not. It depends on how the rest of my week schedules out and how things go in that regard. So looking forward to that as well. Let me see here. I want to also mention the book club, since it's the beginning of the month. For those who are not familiar, we are obviously doing a book club. We're reading one book per month for the entirety of the year. Each month, you have to if you're participating in the book club, you just have to read that one book and come out with a one-page report as a sign of participation. This month's book is The Social Contract by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. It's pretty good book. It's a political philosophy. I'm already started on it. We're that far in. It's a short one. It's 180 pages. However, there is like 45 to 50 pages of introduction. So I don't read much of introductions. I skim through them, especially when the introduction is literally a third of the size of the book. I think that's a little bit egregious. So, it's basically I don't know if I could actually consider this a book. It's almost like four miniature political manifestos inside of like article formats put into one book. It's even split out in that format. It's called Book 1, 2, 3, and 4. But again, they're not really long enough to really be books. Each of them are 20, 30 pages. Excuse me. So I don't know if I would exactly consider that those books. Again, more so articles compiled together. Okay. All right, so that's it for the schedule. Again, if you guys are interested in becoming a part of the book club, you can message me directly on Gab or on Telegram, and I'll get you set up within the group. Again, it's free to do, and I highly recommend it. It's definitely for your own benefit, for everybody's benefit, right? We all benefit from bettering ourselves. So, wanting to read into philosophy, do I have any recommendations? It's a tough read, but my recommendation to start would be The Republic. We're actually going to get into that today. That's what the discussion is about today. That's what we're going to be analyzing. So, stick around today, and you'll get maybe an understanding as to why The Republic is one of my highest recommendation. Not one of. It is my highest recommendation. I think it's by far the best book to read when it comes to philosophy. We're actually going to get into that just in a second here. I'm just going to fix my screen. Let's see. Pull this over. Okay. So I am going to have a visual on the screen here. So for the Speak Free Radio people, you won't be able to see this. It's just a person lecturing inside like a college lecture room. There's nothing you're missing visually. It's mostly we're actually watching this specifically for the audio. So we're gonna play this and we'll pause at times and we'll make our own comments on it. This is a man by the name of Michael Sugru. I believe that's how it's pronounced. He has unfortunately passed away very recently. It was about a month or two ago. Very brilliant man. Very well read on philosophy. And he had a large understanding of pretty much every philosopher you can think of in Western culture. So he has a series where he talks about the greatest men of the Western intellectual tradition, and this is episode one of that series, where he is going to discuss the Republic, which he, as well as myself, regards as probably the best book for Western philosophy. It's kind of the starting project where Western philosophy, ever since then, has expanded upon that, built off of that, and kind of continued that general line of thought, right? There's definitely different thought processes that have kind of spawned from it. However, that is like the birthplace of Western philosophy. So we're going to play this here. Just let me know that the audio is okay in the chat, folks. I want to make sure that, especially for the Speak Free Radio people, they can hear it okay.
The lectures you're about to see cover the last 3,000 years of Western intellectual history. They cover most of the important problems in Western thought and high culture, and they will involve a kind of thinking that most people don't spend most of their time doing. It's called philosophy. The word philosophy comes from two Greek words, the words for love and wisdom, or knowledge. And philosophy is more or less a love of wisdom, a sort of passion for knowledge, which goes beyond what we can get from it, which goes beyond practical concerns. And the intellectual tradition of the West forms a more or less coherent philosophic tradition with a common set of problems, a roughly similar set of issues under consideration, and a similar set of vocabulary words that we use to inquire into philosophical topics. And we might as well consider these vocabulary, this set of terms that we use now, in order to prevent misapprehensions later on. In the first case, we're going to talk about physics and metaphysics. Physics might be thought of as our theory of nature. And roughly speaking, what it means is it's our way of explaining the world around us, the world of sense perception, the world of tables and chairs and of the component parts of tables and chairs, and of the larger things that we encounter, suns, galaxies, worlds, things like that. Our general theory of the world of space and time around us might be described from a philosophical standpoint as being physics. Another set of philosophical issues, another philosophic problem or topic that comes along with our consideration of physics is metaphysics. Metaphysics comes from Greek words meaning above or beyond.
Give me one second here, folks. I think I actually somehow got the wrong link. I don't know how I did this. This was a mistake. Give me one second. We're going to correct that. Yes, I certainly did. My apologies. I have the wrong link. Okay. Sorry. We're starting fresh. My apologies. Okay. Now we're watching the correct video. Sorry about that. I had two links tabbed, and I unfortunately opened the wrong one. Same guy, same basis as we were
describing
before.
Plato's Republic is arguably the greatest achievement in Western philosophy, and it's also one of the greatest achievements in Western literature. It's surely the high point of the ancient political tradition, and it's, naturally enough, the high point of Platonism as well. In this lecture, I'd like to examine the first book of the Republic. There are 10 books, and the reason why I think that the first book is particularly interesting and deserves particular examination on our part is because the main themes of the Republic are stated there, and these main themes of the Republic are the main themes of Platonic philosophy. And the Republic, at least the first book of the Republic, in some ways is a self-contained cabinet or area within the dialogue. It is believed by some German scholars, and I don't know that it's a certainly correct belief, but there has been a conjecture that the first book of the Republic was written as a separate dialogue called the Thrasymachus. And possibly later on it was reworked so that it could be the kind of beginning of a huge and enormously important dialogue, the Republic. And because of the fact that the first book of the Republic seems in some ways to be self-contained, and in other ways seems to be setting up the argument and the thought and the drama of the Republic, it's particularly worth our close examination. Now, Socrates narrates the Republic to an unknown audience. And what he says in the first paragraph, or in the first page, in some ways is the most important paragraph, the most important page in the whole dialogue, or perhaps in all of the Platonic dialogues. It's here that Socrates states the basic themes of the Republic, and in some ways the best basic themes of Platonic political and moral philosophy. And you might compare the Republic, Book 1, to a symphony in which themes are being stated early on that will be developed and articulated, and then we'll fold these themes back into our conclusion at the end. So the basic themes of the Republic get announced in that first sentence, that first paragraph, that first page, the first scene. So there's a sort of microcosm expansion into a macrocosm that we see when we move from the first part of this, of the Republic, to the body of the Republic itself. Now, what happens in the first scene? Well, Socrates says, down I went to Piraeus. Moving up and moving down, once we get to the divided line and the myth of the cave in books 6 and 7, we're going to find are loaded with philosophical significance. Whenever you're low or down, you're in the dark. You're at the bottom of the cave. So when Socrates says, down I went to Piraeus, what he is foreshadowing the philosopher king's move down from the realm of philosophical knowledge to the people, the demos of Athens. The Piraeus, incidentally, is the...
So this is a really important piece. If you read the Republic that he's expanding on right now, where Socrates explains going down into the city, you actually there's a lot of other philosophers that have taken this same line of symbolism. A really good example for those especially who participated in the book club, we read this book. It was called Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Nietzsche. And in this book, Zarathustra is a man who lives up in the mountains, right? As Nietzsche also had this philosophical concept of the hermit. He was essentially an introverted man who was focused on his inner self, right? Focused on learning and bettering himself, and he kept away from the people.
You are a legend in the making, Logos. Thank you for your measured, intelligent, and disciplined approach. We need more leaders in the movement like you.
Order, brother, with a $15 investment. Guys, can we get some Romans in the chat for order? Thank you very much, my friend. And a very kind comment. He says, you are a legend in the making, Logos. Thank you for your measured, intelligent, and disciplined approach. We need more leaders like you in the movement. Thank you very kindly, brother. I really do appreciate a comment like that, and I greatly appreciate the support as well. Your support is what helps the stream to continue. And don't forget, folks, if you are watching and you do want to help this stream out and keep me rolling, right down in the description on Odyssey, you can find all of the links to support. We've got crypto wallets. You can obviously do a super chat through Entropy, as he just did, and then there's also... straight through Odyssey as well itself. So anyways, Nietzsche talks about this concept of the hermit, which is this introverted person who focuses on enlightenment and self-betterment, but away from the people, right? Now, when you think a hermit, you would think underground you think of a hermit crab, right? They hide in a shell and they're ground level, they're low, or they're sea level, right? So he explains... that although Zarathustra is the hermit, he's the hermit in a cave up on the mountain, okay? And the reason he's up on the mountain is the same reason that Sugru is explaining right here that Socrates uses as symbolism, is that he is above the common man, okay? Intellectually, philosophically, he has reached this higher enlightenment. He is above the common man. So Zarathustra, in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, he goes down into the town. And as he is walking down, as he's going down to speak with the common folk, he comes into people, and as he's coming down the mountain and speaking to individuals, these individuals become less and less enlightened the farther down the mountain they become. Once they're in the mass of humanity, their level of intellect, their level of humanity, so to speak, is lowered and almost non-existent in some cases. So that's the symbolism that Socrates is using here, and he's created this symbolism, which has been echoed in a lot of other philosophy, again, which is why we read books that kind of run in tandem like this. So we'll let Sugru continue here a little bit.
the center of democratic politics in Athens. In other words, it's the place where most foreigners are, and it's the place where the shipping goes on. And there's a lot of interchange with the external world, and it's a democratic stronghold. So when Socrates says, down I went to Piraeus, what we see there is the philosopher coming down. Now that's just the first line. What happens when he gets down there is that he and Glaucon, his companion, go to see a festival and to pray. In other words, they go for two reasons. One, for entertainment, to become spectators, theorists in the original Greek sense, and also for reasons of piety. They want to see the torch, parade for the goddess, and they want to see the various rites that are going on. And after observing these rites, they go back up. They intend to move back up symbolically to a level of philosophical sophistication. Glaucon is certainly the most admirable and impressive of the interlocutors in this dialogue. So Socrates and Glaucon are about to go back up when a slave boy comes up and says, stop, you cannot go anywhere. Now, the slave boy belongs to Polemarchus, an acquaintance of Socrates. His father is also known to Socrates. His father is Cephalus. And the slave boy orders them to wait, and Glaucon takes the initiative and says, yes, we'll wait. And then Polemarchus eventually comes up with a number of other Athenian gentlemen, and they say, and there's a very important interchange in that first page of the dialogue. What happens is this. The gentlemen that are accompanying Polemarchus come up to Socrates and Glaucon and say, we want you to come to our house. Don't go anywhere. You cannot get away. You know, we want you to come with us. And Socrates says, well, we had really planned to get away. We really hadn't expected to spend much time here down in Piraeus. And he says, none of that. See how many of us there are? See how few of you there are? Either prove stronger than us or come with us. Now, what we have here is the establishment of the basic theme of the Republic, the dialectic between power and knowledge. The people with the power don't know what they're talking about. They're not philosophers. The one philosopher, the man that has real political knowledge, is the one that is subject to the many.
So again, the concept that is described here, using symbolism yet again, when he explains the difference between the power and the knowledge, when you read the Republic, most of the discussion of the Republic is a complaint that the people who actually run society, the people that are supposed to be the protectors of society and helping society and kind of uplifting it, the government, so to speak, who govern the state, these people are, for the most part, not intellectuals. There are very few to be found. And because of that, society as a mass suffers, right? They impose their power upon society simply because they have the power, but not for the correct reasons. So in this book, they'll come to discuss the importance of what they call the philosopher kings. These are people who rule over society. They're the kings of society. However, they're philosophers at the same time. And again, philosopher, as he described very briefly in the first video, which I accidentally played, philosopher means lover of wisdom. That's the etymology of the word. Philo being love, and sophist or sophia would be knowledge, wisdom, okay? So philosophy, right? So these are lovers of wisdom, and by stating that they're lovers of wisdom, what it means is they care about all categories of knowledge, whether this is math, military, science, human betterment, you name it. The idea is a philosopher king will be able to look out for all of the affairs of the public and ensure that the people are happy and satisfied for in every single category of a public affair. Again, whether this be actually guiding the military, right, so that we're not just getting our people killed on accident with bad militaristic blunders. Additionally, being well-versed in science so we can keep our people healthy with any kind of medicines that are obviously, we're not talking about pharmaceutical medicines. We're talking about advancements that are purely of beneficial usage, right? Whether that be actually benefiting the people educationally, making sure that they're teaching themselves to actually be better individuals, both in body, mind, and spirit, something that our society today completely lacks. It does actually the counteraction of that. It does the opposite, right? It doesn't actually teach anybody to be intelligent or better. Again, a famous quote from Rockefeller, who created our educational system, he stated, we're here to breed workers, not thinkers, right? So this really encapsulates that entire problem, is that these people are imposing their power, but they have no actual knowledge to provide to the public, right? This is why I actually recommend a lot of people, before you read Mein Kampf, which again is a book that we consider to be kind of a cornerstone of our movement. Not kind of, it is. It's a very large cornerstone of our movement. Before you actually partake in reading this book, I highly recommend that you read The Republic by Plato, in which these dialogues are displayed, because you'll get a better understanding of what Hitler was actually fulfilling on a societal level, right? When you see the ills expressed perfectly in The Republic, and then you see how Hitler was able to essentially take that philosopher king role and fix these ills for his people, again, not as just a person imposing his power on the people for no reason, but imposing his intellect upon the people in order to help them better themselves. And again, this was a man who was well-versed in many fields. He was well-versed in philosophy, in military endeavors, in geographical understanding, in historical understanding, in human betterment, and the helping of the spirit. He had knowledge within all of these categories. And again, one which is absolute key that people have to understand is he had knowledge of the Jewish question, or the Jewish problem, the Jewish issue, whatever we want to call it today. He had a deep understanding of that issue. And without a deep understanding of that issue, you're unable to understand most of the ills that are present within our society today, right? You may understand the symptoms of the problem, but without understanding the source, that being the Jewish framework, the Jewish mindset, you can't understand why these problems exist. Again, we can see communism as a problem. We can see liberalism as a problem. We can see transgenderism as a problem, pedophilia as a problem. We can see all of these things as a problem. But without pointing to the source which perpetrates and keeps this problem alive in today's society, we'll never actually solve these symptoms, right? Again, using this this analogy of a disease, you can treat the symptoms, but if you're not treating the disease, what's the point, right? So if I have a stuffy nose, or if I have a sore throat, well, let's say I have a flu, right? And if I take I have a stuffy nose because of that flu, well, I can take some kind of a nasal spray or something like that in order to clear the stuffy nose. But the flu is still there. My fever is still existent, right? I'm not fixing my fever by putting nasal spray in my nose so that my nose clears up. I'm just making it more comfortable for myself, right? So you can clear out this LGBT stuff. You can clear out pedophilia out of your society. But at the end of the day, you're making it more comfortable. You're delaying the inevitable because these symptoms will return if you do not go to that source and clear out that source. Okay? We'll go further back here. We'll allow him to continue now.
So what we have here is the imbalance between power and knowledge. That theme gets stated again and again and again, the interaction between force and persuasion. Socrates says, well, isn't there one more possibility that we could persuade you to let us go? And one of the men that have come up to arrest them, to stop their progress, says, well, could you persuade us if we don't listen? Think about that in terms of the apology. Think about that in terms of the death of Socrates. Think about that in terms of Socrates' place within the polis, his function as something within the city but also external to the city. He's an alien in the city of his birth. So when all these framing dialogues, when the first part of any of the dialogues happens, give those special care. In this particular case, because this is the greatest of the Platonic dialogues, the framing scene, the first scene, is of the utmost consequence, because all symbolically the greatest themes of the Republic are being represented there. The connection between force and knowledge, the place of the philosopher in the city, the relationship between the philosopher and the demos are all represented there. It's this disjunction between power and knowledge that makes the Republic necessary, that makes an inquiry into the nature of a good political order absolutely necessary. So at the end of this little discussion, and it only goes for about a page when they decide to go to Cephalus's house, Socrates doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to associate with these guys. He wants to go back up again. And when we get to book 6 and 7, you'll find out what up and down mean in this. But he intends to move up to the realm of the sun. He doesn't want to talk to these people. But as we find out in book 7 of the Republic as well, the philosopher must be made to come down among the people, because that's good for him, and it's good for the people as well. The philosopher may not enjoy it, but there's a sort of moral obligation. Now, the moral obligation in this case is submerged under the obligations imposed by force, but one overlaps the other in this case. So,
again, I want to pick up on this concept one more time. If we discuss Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which I think actually Nietzsche clearly understood this symbolism and then used it himself and kind of expanded upon that symbolism. So when you read Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Zarathustra doesn't necessarily want to go down to the people, right? So I want to actually explain the first encounter that Zarathustra has in this book. So Zarathustra comes walking down the mountain, and as he comes walking down the mountain, the first person he encounters is a guy who's still pretty high up on the mountain, but he's not at the mountaintop where Zarathustra was. And this man is living on a farm by himself, away from the people. He's still heightened in the clouds, right? So when Zarathustra comes down to go down towards the town, he bumps into this farm and he stops and talks to the farmer for a second. And the guy says, "Well, you know, don't you know the people down there are going to hate you? I have no interest in talking to them because I don't want to deal with their filth," right? So Zarathustra kind of informs him that, well, I don't necessarily want to go down, but the people require it, right? And I have been summoned as the higher man to come down and help them. So Nietzsche took this concept of the higher man, the philosopher, and he turned it into his own terminology, which is where we get this Übermensch from, right? A man beyond man, so to speak. The Übermensch, which in modern English, it can translate to the overman, it can translate to Superman. Unfortunately, if we translate it in the Superman sense, we look at the Marvel superhero character Superman, which was invented by Jews. It's actually a subversion of this philosophy. It indicates that the common man is the Superman, right? So this is how Jews subvert your philosophy, okay? They've taken Superman, this concept of this the overman, right, the Übermensch, a man who goes beyond this animal instinct and this lower, like, regular behavior of the common man. He's above that, right? He's above what we consider as common morality, right? So when you read, or when you look into what Superman is, when the Jews created this Marvel character, he's just an ordinary Joe, right, who has these superpowers, right, making him the Übermensch, but he's not the Übermensch philosophically, only physically, right? So he takes this this form of a Übermensch, but in reality, he's still in the realm of morality, right? So in Nietzsche's philosophy, the Übermensch is above morality. So in the Jews' philosophy, essentially, the Jewish philosophy, when they created Superman as a character, he is completely bound up with morality. So Nietzsche says it's beyond good and evil, it's above morality. And the Jew says, no, actually, Goy, Superman is a moral character. So then they framework for you what is moral and immoral, right? So for example, in the Superman comics, everything is literally in the mind frame of good and bad. What is good? What is bad? What is good? What is bad? That's how all superhero things are framed, is good and bad. There's no philosophical higher pinpoint to look at and say, well, it's beyond that in some cases, right? Which is what Nietzsche's whole philosophy was. Again, he wrote a book entitled Beyond Good and Evil. It's beyond that, right? Well, the Jew doesn't believe that there's anything beyond that, or rather, they don't want you to believe that there is anything beyond that. So they simplified this, they put this into the masses of the people, and people ate it up because it's simplistic. And then they go even farther, and they state, well, let's watch this one comic. They actually have Superman beating the living hell out of Hitler, right? Well, this is a huge moral subversion because Hitler was actually the definition of the Superman, the Übermensch, right? He was a man above other men, a philosophical genius who rose above the crowd and tried to uplift the crowd with him, right? So the Jew takes this concept, he takes the actual overman and has the Jewish Superman beating up the real Übermensch, what an actual Übermensch is, right? It's not only is it a psychological subversion of our philosophy, it's also a physical subversion of it in a visual depiction, right? This goes so far beyond what most people recognize. They will do this with everything that we hold as cultural achievements, okay? So they take this Superman character, which is the Jewish version of that Obermann, that Übermensch, and they have him destroy our version of it, and then they praise that as good and holy, and they put R's as evil and hateful and awful, right? So they take, they're imposing a Jewish morality into our worldview of what morality is, if that makes sense to you. It's very important that you understand that, especially with Superman. It's something that isn't talked about very often, but that's a massive subversion of our philosophies. George R., thank you, brother. Welcome to the chat. Mariner, welcome. Lex, seeing a couple new people coming in. Ape, welcome, my friend. Hello, guys. All right, we're going to continue here.
At the end of this little dialogue, or this little vignette, this framing scene, they say, well, there are lots of them, and there's only two of us. And Glaucon says, well, okay, we'll go. At this point, what's very important is that Socrates doesn't make any decisions. Glaucon is making decisions for himself and for Socrates. Why? Well, because in an unhealthy state, in a badly organized political entity, inferior men make decisions for philosophers. Right? In other words, all the symbolism is going on, and this is only the first page into it. So what you will want to do after you read The Republic is read this first book again, and read this first page or two three or four times. The Republic is a funny sort of a book. I always tell my students when I lecture on this that you can't really read The Republic for the first time until you've read it two or three times. Strange as that may seem, in order to really get yourself in a position where you can appreciate what's going on, where you can begin to ask the intelligent questions, you have to pay your dues and slog through it twice or three times. In particular, this first book is of great importance for that. So at the end of this little decision, they take a vote. And, of course, Socrates says, I guess I've got to go with him. Everybody's voting to take me on to Cephalus's house. The idea of this group of men spontaneously turning into a democracy is of great significance. Why? Because it means that we're going to make a whole series of comments about Athenian democracy. And we'll talk later on about various kinds of regime, and one of these kinds of regime will be the democratic regime. And we'll find that Polemarchus, the gentleman who says, you stay here, you're coming with us, he turns out to be, at least initially, the archetype of the democratic man. So the city is like the man will be one of the key themes of the book. And when we go back, we'll find out that the connection between the city and the man is being forged much earlier than you might have guessed on a first reading. So take my word for it. When you are reading The Republic, you must go back and read it more than once. But in particular, this first scene and this first book are crucial to your understanding of this.
So again, I want to pick up, again, he talks about this situation where they use this symbolism again, that a group of essentially buffoons, there's a reason they're slaves, and it's not the king that comes and pulls him in. It's slaves because it insinuates that they're the lower class men. These are the people that are meant to be voters of society or choosers within a democracy, right? So much like today, the heightened man or the intellectual of today is obviously a rare occurrence. It's very slim to find. But the intellectual of today, they are forced to bend their will to the majority, right? This is what a democracy does to our people. This is actually a gripe that Hitler had himself. It was a complaint that, look, democracy, it's essentially just the mass number of the weakest imposing their will upon the strong. In what sense ever in nature does the weak impose the will upon the strong? In natural life, in natural living, you cannot name a single circumstance where the weak imposes their will upon the strong, right? Because you have to have more strength in order to impose that onto somebody, to force your will on someone. You have to be stronger than them, whether that's intellectually, whether that's physically, you name it. You have to be above them in some way. But in modern society, in the modern form of a democracy, and not just modern, because again, it's being symbolized, this is 2,300 years ago, it's being symbolized all the way back then, this same exact concept that democracy, it forces the heightened man, the man who is above the rest, right, to now make the decisions with the rest, because the rest have the say, because there's thousands of them. So we get a situation, today we can discuss this in very easy symbolic terms, right? Today, you can flood our country with extremely low IQ immigrants who have zero civilizational understanding, they have zero background in philosophy, they have zero understanding of theology, right? They are actually, by definition, animalistic creatures, because they have no higher understanding. This is what is characteristic of humanity. They haven't been taught morals, they haven't been taught civilizational living, they have not been taught religion or theology, which gives you those moral precepts. They don't have any of that knowledge. So we're bringing literal animalistic creatures in among us, And then we're giving them, okay, now you can vote. Well, when these people vote, they're not going to vote for what's actually best. They're going to vote what appears best. So therefore, now our ruling class, instead of having an incentive to be what's best for the people, they have actually a higher incentive to make a picture of what is best for a specific group of people because they are creating a larger voting class, right? So now it's actually more based on manipulation rather than higher living, if that makes sense. We'll continue onwards here.
Well, they get to Polemarchus's house, and his father, Cephalus, is there. Cephalus is a very aged man, and he's just finished the sacrifices. He has a wreath of a ceremonial wreath on his head, and he comes in and he warmly greets Socrates. And he says, Socrates, we don't see very much of you down here in Piraeus. Of course, when you read the words Piraeus, you're supposed to think here in the democratic stronghold of Athens, because after all, democratic Athens killed Socrates. Right? The man who claims to know more claims not to be the equal of every other man. And that means in some ways it's a fundamental antagonism between the philosophical project and the democratic city. So when Cephalus says, we don't see you much down here in Piraeus, the democratic stronghold, what he's saying is, wow, this is something unusual, philosopher among the people. Socrates engages in a very short interchange with Cephalus, but it's symbolically very significant. Cephalus has just come in from doing the ancestral sacrifices, and Socrates says, you know, Cephalus, you're an old man, and it's not that I'm so young, but you're certainly a good deal older than I am, a generation or so. Please.
Folks, Ape Lincoln with a $114.88 donation. Guys, can we get some Romans in the chat for Ape? Very kind donation. We got the situation handled the other day with the accidental donation that got fixed up. Thank you so much, brother, for being a man of your word and continuing to support my work. Ape says, we need to support the creators we love or fear them not being able to. They put their faces and reputation for us and their values. Even if we pitch in only a few dollars a stream, / to chat, Logos, and the future. Thank you very much, brother. Make sure you guys get the Romans in the chat for him. Man of his word, true Aryan man. Thank you, my friend. I really do appreciate it. Very kind of you, and I'm very glad that everything got settled on that side. Thank you, brother. I greatly appreciate it. And you're correct. You know, I have a hard time on a moral standpoint, you know, kind of rattling the coffee mug and asking for spare change. You know, it's actually for me a demeaning thing to do because I don't necessarily believe really even in this physical financial system myself. So I do appreciate that, brother. Thank you very much. It's very kind of you. Yes, absolutely. They hated the materialistic lifestyle, certainly. Well, actually, only the philosopher class hated it. I'm sure there was many of the ancient Greeks that were, again, the common man who appreciated a lifestyle as such. Sorry for the abrupt pause, folks. I just wanted to make sure I thank that. Very kind investment. I greatly appreciate that. Martin Luther, I would love to. I would certainly love to. I enjoy teaching and discussing specifically philosophy. I love having philosophical conversation. It's something I greatly enjoy. Yes, they talk often in a lot of those older works about the ills of materialism, the falseness of it.
What's it like to get old? In other words, there's not much more that Socrates might want to find out from Cephalus because he's not a great thinker, but he does have some experience that Socrates doesn't. Maybe it'll be edifying for all these other young men. What's it like to get old? Do you like it? Has it been good or bad? What do you think of it? You know, a lot of people complain about it. What's your word on it? And Cephalus says, it's not so bad. You know, at one time, I thought that it would be terrible, but I found that old age is bearable provided you have money. And Socrates says, well, why do you need money? He says, well, you know, here's a problem that I've had. When I was young, I was a real sport. Right? I like sex and wine and money and power, and I like the sort of allurements of the external world. In other words, in his younger years, Cephalus was what might be called an erotic man. Not erotic in the limited sense of just sexually erotic, but he had lots of desire. He wanted things. And he was not terribly scrupulous in the way he got the things that he wanted, because good sensation or pleasure seemed to be the best thing that one could obtain, according to Cephalus. So he said, I did that all my younger years, and I had quite a good time. I lived a good life. I made some money, and, you know, I've been happy living here in Athens, particularly because I'm not a citizen. You know, he's a foreigner, what's called a medic. And Cephalus says, now that I've gotten older, you know, I start to worry about the gods and divine retribution. In other words, I did some things that perhaps I'm not proud of nowadays. And I look back on my life, and, you know, I used to laugh at these stories about Hades and the bad stuff that happened to you after you die. But now, you know, I'm starting to contemplate my own death. And it turns out, at least implicitly, the contemplation of death is salutary. In other words, he starts to think about the fact that he's not going to be here forever, and the gods may have been, like, adding all this up and saying that you're going to pay after you die. So Cephalus says, I started to worry about that. So here's the good thing about money. It gives you a happy old age. You can take that money and pay back everybody that you've stolen from, right? And, you know, do a kind of deal there so that, look, I know that I got over on you, and I know that I swindled you, but here's some money back. What do you say we'll call it even? So you can make amends with human beings, and also, this is crucial, you can bribe the gods. You know, the gods are still going to be ticked off at you, but if you do the right sacrifices and you say the right prayers and you go through the right ceremonies, the gods are going to give you a get-out-of-hell-free card, right? You get it, you know, it's like Monopoly. You don't have to go to Hades and have terrible things happen to you. Now, this is important because this is the kind of thing that motivates Cephalus. In other words, he's a superstitious, erotic sort of a man, and he's gotten to the point where his eros has diminished so that the reasoning part, or at least the part that has a conscience, can become important, if not take over, because he would clearly be an erotic man now if his body hadn't collapsed. Right, he gives a wonderful quote from, I believe, Sophocles. Someone came up to Sophocles when he was an old man and said, Sophocles, can you still have sex with a woman? Are you still, you know, or have you become impotent as an old man? And Sophocles says, nay, man, I was very glad to become impotent. It was like getting away from a harsh and cruel master. I'm much better off not getting involved with sex. Thank God this has been taken away from me. And Cephalus approves this. He says, you know, that's about the best thing that could happen to you, not to have erotic drives at all. It makes you nice to other people. It makes you nice to yourself. It means that you can possibly be a moral human being. This is symbolically significant as well as quite funny. The symbolic significance is that the Republic, to a great extent, is about the organization and direction of human desire. Eros, the eros for sex, or the eros for knowledge, or the eros for power, or the eros for honor, will be the distinguishing characteristics in the various sorts of souls and in the various kinds of regime. So in other words, what you love, of what you want, what you desire, will be the characteristic sort of pole of your soul and of the city that corresponds to a given soul. Cephalus' city is clearly the city of unrestrained desire. Right? While he still has a young man's desires, he behaves in an immoral way. When the young man's desires wane and he now has the kind of limited, partial desires of an old man, then he says, you know what, I like speeches a lot more now than I used to. And Socrates must be thinking, well, look, if I could have done anything for you, I would have had you like speeches 20, 30, 40 years ago, so you could have lived a good and virtuous life. Now you're an old man, you're about to die, and now you tell me you like speeches? It's too late now, my friend. So Socrates doesn't say this, of course. Socrates says, well, what can you tell me about justice and money and how they're connected? And Socrates and Cephalus says to him, well, it helps you avoid the wrath of the gods. It helps you not do injustice to any other man. And it may be very hard to be poor and virtuous, I mean, because he can't imagine a virtuous man not having any money, but think of Socrates. But Cephalus says, well, so long as you're moderately good and you have some respect for the gods and you have some money, old age is really quite bearable. Well, Socrates asks him about the nature of justice, you know, what's involved in justice, and Cephalus tells him there's two things involved in justice. One, to tell the truth, which is probably not the strongest of Cephalus's early adventures. And two, it's to give back what is owed. In other words, Cephalus has a very pedestrian sort of a mind. He's been in business all his life. And he says, look, if you borrow something from somebody, you should give it back to him. That's justice. And if you tell somebody something, it should be the truth. That's justice. Now, it's not that those things aren't parts of the truth, but one can imagine circumstances in which it might be just not to give something back or not to tell the truth. And you can imagine other things that might be included in a more elaborate and a more detailed conception of justice. In other words, Cephalus's definition of justice is very unsound. It's limited, and it doesn't completely overlap the true form of justice, as we'll find out later. Well, Socrates says, well, look, you tell me that it's just to give back what is owed, but suppose you borrow a sword from somebody and the guy goes crazy. Do you have to give him back the sword then? Now think about the reason why he chooses this example. And again, this is another thing you're going to have to look at very carefully when you read The Republic, but also when you read the dialogues as a whole. Nothing happens by accident, and Plato never chooses an example from nowhere. The examples are always intended to show you something about the character or the soul of the person being talked to. Right? The reason why he chooses a sword in the case of Cephalus is Cephalus is almost completely selfish. And a sword, if you give it back to someone that's crazy, he may kill you with it. So the reason why you ought not to give back a sword when you borrow it from someone that's insane is because of your own self-interest. Right?
So again, a very interesting piece. So when Socrates has conversations with people, and this is why we should learn as well to have these kinds of... Excuse me. This is why we as well should learn to have this kind of ability in rhetoric. When he speaks to a certain person, he tailors the conversation specifically to said person, right? Therefore, it becomes more appealing to them, if that makes sense. So as he explained, you know, if you're a self-interested person, if I framework an argument against you, right, I might want to make it seem like it's something that's going to harm your own character, right? Or if you're a man who loves money, I might want to frame the conversation when I'm trying to teach you against that by using something that literally speaks upon you actually losing money or insinuates that you may lose some of that wealth, right? Speaking of which, Lex in chat says, the accruing of money today and to remain ethical is nearly impossible. Capitalism as it exists presupposes that someone gets ripped off. Yeah, so you have to look at it like this. The way our system is now built up, our form of capitalism, and this is the problem with untamed capitalism, right? And this is yet another issue we have with this is probably my largest gripe with right-wing conservative types, right? Who are a very anti-government. They don't want the government in their business. You know, they want to be able to kind of do their own thing, and they don't want any regulations or things like that. Well, unregulated capitalism turns into literally what we have today, right? Because we had unregulated capitalism for a very long time, and it's proceeded and proceeded and proceeded and proceeded. And then we had, like, fake regulations on the capitalism, but the regulations actually ended up doing more harm to the workers or the lower class than it actually does to the CEOs and et cetera. But this untamed, unregulated capitalism turns into what we have today, where the only way to actually get a leg up is to be willing to break moral boundaries, right? You have to be willing to be a shyster, for instance, right? You just have to be somebody who's willing to kind of get a leg up on somebody by screwing one or by, you know, shaming another person or leaving somebody out of a deal. There's so many... well, let's look at, for example, one of the best examples of this would be... one in the chat, if you folks have seen the movie, it's called The Founder. It's one of the very few movies I've actually seen and remember. It's about the man who essentially stole the McDonald's franchise from the original people. What if you've seen that, too, if you've not? What if you have, too, if you haven't? Okay, we've got a little bit of twos, a little bit of ones. So, for those who haven't seen it, this film is extremely symbolic of the ills of again, unregulated capitalism and how bad and immoral this form of a system can be. Because it creates, for most men, let's just look in general, in a capitalistic society, right, what is there to aim for to get power in society? Money, that's it. Right? Money is power in a capitalistic society. No matter what, that's just the way it is. So whether you want a TV show, whether you want a seat in government, whether you want a nice car, whether you want to be the head of a great organization that actually does charity work, you need money. You need capital in a capitalistic society. That's the way it works. So If you want to get capital over other people, you have to be willing to swindle some people. That's how that's this is why Jews function so well in a capitalistic society, because they have literal thousands, millennia of training in swindling. They've managed to become professional in this field. It's a field that we don't know anything about, both because, one, we don't practice it, so we're not aware of it, and two, it's against our moral precepts as a people, right? Again, this idea of the Aryan, right, which that's what we call the collective white peoples. Unfortunately, I think today some of us are so deluded, I wouldn't even call white people today Aryan on mass scale. There are some that are lacking in that capability, that quality. But Aryan, it means noble, okay? A nobleman would feel wrong in order to wrong somebody else or swindle somebody else in order to get a leg up, right? So to us, that's completely against our actual moral concept, right? So let's go back to this film, this McDonald's film. If you haven't seen this film, McDonald's started as this small little mom-and-pop shop, this brick-and-mortar store of two brothers who opened up a hamburger store, right? And then this guy, Ray Kroc, decided, hey, well, you know, I want to help them out. I want to push this milkshake machine on them and try to get them to buy the milkshake machine. So they bought the milkshake machine. Then he goes, well, you know, I can help you here, right? So at first he comes across as this guy who genuinely just wants to help, and he might have been a guy that just really wanted to help. But he's struggling in his family life and his personal life, and the only thing that mattered anymore was to gain power, which, again, comes through money in this capitalistic society. So he ends up convincing these guys that they should franchise. And he runs this massive swindle on them where he buys the land on which they are supposed to franchise their businesses and has them invest in the businesses and rent the land. And then, through this legal loophole, he's able to essentially steal all of their businesses because they're on his land that he bought, right? So he swindled these two guys. First off, they didn't want a franchise. They just wanted their little mom-and-pop shop. They were humble, noble men who just wanted to kind of create a nice business where people could come and enjoy themselves. And it was their way of, just a self-owned little thing, right? They didn't want this to be some big corporate entity, right? Well, this motherfucker came in, convinced them to franchise, convinced them to make this thing corporate. And then as they did that process, he essentially used them in that process that he got them to build it, right? And then he stole what they built, okay? Now, I've got my speculations about what Ray Kroc could have been. I ain't going to make any statements because there's no proof on the matter. But it's quite obvious this kind of mindset, who functions best in this worldview or this type of behavior, right? So now we have this immoral corporate structure. So this did several things wrong, right? Not only did it destroy the two men who built this thing from the ground as noble people, but it turned this entire franchise, this corporate structure, into an immoral stain on all of society. It's a cancer on all of society, and quite literally, too. I don't even mean that figuratively. It is a cancer on society. It literally causes cancer. People go in there, they order these things, they get cancer, okay? Additionally, it's causing obesity. So now this corporate franchise, this corporate greed for one individual to have all these businesses, right? That one corporate greed, it's created obesity, which is a tax on our healthcare system. It's created cancers, which is another tax on our healthcare system. So now if you're a moral, upstanding, philosophical person, this capitalistic democracy has yet again slighted you. You have to pay your taxes, you have to pay your dues in order to upkeep the people who refuse to live virtuously, who live in vice and go and stop at McDonald's every single day in the drive-thru on the way home from work. You are now forced to uphold their health financially, okay? This is what the system has done. This is it's like a snowball effect. As one thing goes wrong, the vices compound, and then eventually we're faced with an avalanche, right? Holokoff with a 25 library coin investment, he says, I think personally the culture of lawfare is more problematic than capitalism. If you notice, it was a Jew which pushed the real estate grab, which was critical to McDonald's rapid growth. That's a really good point. Can we get the Romans in the chat for Holokoff? Thank you very much. That is a very good point. Lawfare is a big problem as well. And that's why it's very important that we set up a system where lawfare can't be used to subvert our own system, right? So, for example, Samuel Roth, the Jew who came in and got porn legalized as free speech, right? Look, porn isn't speech. It's not speech, right? But he used this little legal loophole and played a technicality game and got it legalized because, well, it's free speech. If I want to talk about it, I should be able to talk about it, right? That's bullshit. It's not free speech. Again, founding fathers, they wrote this constitution. They stated upon writing this constitution, they stated exactly this. It is for a moral and upstanding virtuous people. Okay, that's the only people that this constitution will ever apply to, right? So the second we allow immoral things to be used under the guise of our constitution, we already lost. It's over. And that's what we did with this, specifically with the porn, right? It's not free speech.
And that immediately appeals to Kefla, and Kefla says, okay, yeah, you're right, you shouldn't give back a sword to somebody that's crazy. That's not justice. Right, so that was very carefully chosen, and there's only a 3 or 4 page interaction, but there's a lot of symbolic business going on there. He's introducing some of the major themes. Now, just as we get to this point, Kefla says, well, okay, I guess my theory of justice is not quite adequate, but I got to go take care of the sacrifices. You know, I'm in the midst of doing these religious rituals. Look, my soul's got all these sins on it. I want to go take care of business. So I leave the argument to my son, Polemarchus. Couple of points here. Number one, we have to get rid of Kephalus. Why? Because he represents ancient ancestral piety. It's superstitious, and it's not morally good, but it's not morally completely corrupt either. We have to get rid of the old man and the old ways and the old religions before we can embark upon our real discussion of justice. So we'll state the themes in a light and airy way in the early part of the dialogue. But first thing first, we're going to have to get rid of the established usages, particularly the established religion. So his son, Polemarchus, is going to become, quote, the heir of the dialogue. Like all the other property that Kephalus has, and Kephalus and Polemarchus are very interested in property, he says, you're my son, Polemarchus. You take it up. I'm going to go do the sacrifice. So he's out, and he's not going to come back for the rest of the dialogue. This is important because we have to clear the slate before we embark on our expedition in search of justice. So let's get rid of all the established usages. It would be impious to include Kephalus in this. Kephalus is an old man that's done the best he could to improve his soul. It's not going to get any better. The best thing you can do is to step back, let him go, show respect, and then bring in, move from antiquated religious beliefs to living philosophy. Let's get the young man that can still be changed, that has life ahead of him. Polemarchus, then, first thing he does is appeal to Simonides. He says, at least if Simonides is to be believed, justice is giving back, is giving what is due. And Socrates says, well, that's a very interesting thing. A couple of points here. The only time that Polemarchus or anybody else for the rest of the dialogue is going to appeal to authority is right here. In other words, after we get rid of old established religious convention, the next thing we're going to get rid of is appeals to authority. So Socrates is going to go in and inquire into what Polemarchus has to say, and he's going to say to Polemarchus, well, first of all, what does Simonides mean when he says that justice is giving what is due? And Polemarchus says, well, I think it's doing help to friends. In other words, helping your friends out. That's what's due. And Socrates says, well, that's interesting. I mean, I can believe that you should help your friends. What sort of thing should you do to help, and what should you do to enemies? What happens then? Well, Polemarchus thinks he knows. He says, well, here's what you should do. You should do good things for friends, help out your friends, and do harm to your enemies, injure your enemies. Well, that turns out to be a problem. It turns out that, first of all, justice, which is supposed to be the most important of virtues and everyone praises, turns out to be useful in contracts, for example. If you agree to perform a certain contract, then you go and do it later on. The difficulty is that it seems that if you are able to perform contracts accurately and justly, justice will also allow you to perform them unjustly. If it allows you to preserve wealth, it allows you to steal wealth. If it allows you to do some good to friends, it also allows you to do some hurt to friends. How do you know that justice is only morally good, and how do you know that justice demands that we do harm to enemies? Well, Polemarchus gets a little flustered. He restates his argument, and then he says, well, okay, I think that let's leave Simonides out of it, first of all. Right? He pulls away and starts to think for himself, which is an important step in the dialogue. And Socrates says, well, if you want to find out the real nature of justice, you have to find out what you owe other people and what sort of things are due to them. Now, let's take it as agreed that we have to do help to enemies. We have to benefit, or we have to do help to friends. We have to benefit our friends. But what should a good man do to an enemy? Does a good man have any enemies? Well, Polemarchus says, yeah, you should injure them or harm them. Socrates comes back and goes after
him. This is very ambitious material to tackle.
He says, well, look.
Quite impressive, Zach. Thank you for generous effort and investment in others.
Wow, just give me some truth with a $100 entropy investment. Guys, can we get, please throw the Romans up in the chat for just give me some truth. Very, very, very kind. I greatly appreciate that. It's the words more than the investment. They said, this is very ambitious material to tackle. Quite impressive, Zach. Thank you for generous effort and investment in others. Thank you, first off, for investing in me, and thank you even more so for just taking some kind of value out of my work. I greatly appreciate that. That means a lot to me. Thank you, genuinely. It's a very very high comment. Thank you.
If you wanted to do something just or virtuous for horses, you would.
And Lex, thank you very much. I appreciate that as well. Zero attribution to my parents. They were not in my life at all. Thank you though.
Improve the horse, right? You wouldn't make it worse, in other words, and you would improve it with reference to the virtue of horses. In other words, here we bring in the word arete, which can be translated as virtue, can be translated as excellence, but the idea is that when you want to treat a horse well, when you know about horsemanship, what you do are things that improve the arete of the horse. You improve the virtue of the horse as a horse. You don't want to give the horse the virtue of a table or the virtue of a sheep. You want to give it the virtue particularly and exclusively appropriate to it. Same sort of argument applies when we're dealing with human beings. When you want to treat a human being justly, you don't diminish them with reference to human virtue. When you want to deal with people justly, you improve them in human virtue. Socrates then makes the argument that the good man does no one any harm. The good man does exclusively good things, both to people he considers friends and to whoever it is that might be considered his enemy. There's an argument to make that the good man has no enemies, that there are people that may feel evilly disposed towards a good man, like Socrates or like some other good man, but that Socrates himself has no enemies. He benefits those people that like him, but he also does his best to benefit those people that don't like him. And
this is a really good key point. This is something that's really hard to adopt and is lacking yet again in most of, sadly, our movement. We see a lot of this, right? A lot of people who, they have good morals. They have this good moral standing. And they're very good to those that they consider friends. You know, they'll help them out financially, they'll help them out physically, they'll kind of promote them, do things for them. We're not really lacking in good men in that sense within our movement. Where we lack is the ability of those good men to refrain from trying to harm those they dislike. This is a really big problem that we have, right? Rather than attacking guys within our movement that we disagree with or don't like their methodology or we don't like their explanations of things, rather than attacking them, we should be uplifting them, pulling them into the correct direction, right? At the end of the day, if there's a situation, let's say we want to plan an event or we want to plan something in regards to our movement, and you think version A, and I think version B, one of us, by logical nature, has to be correct. That's not to say that one is entirely wrong. One might have good points, and those things might be correct within their points, but the overall thing will cause more harm than good, right? The idea always is to create more good than harm, more beneficial things than negative things, for the betterment of our society and of our people, right? So if we're doing that, one of our methods has to be more efficient in doing so. So rather than saying, fuck you, You're incorrect. I disagree with you. It's very important that we say, you know, I don't agree with that. I'm not sure that I think that's correct. And here is why. This is what we have to learn is here is why, with a explanation behind our belief, right? And through this dialogue, through this back and forth of explaining why you're wrong, back and forth, we can come to a conclusion in which somebody is correct, right? We see this throughout the entirety of the Republic, right? This whole book is a framework of Socrates having these dialogues with people in a calm and hopeful manner in which he questions them back and forth, right? And he says, you this, you that, you this, you that, right? And they, in almost every circumstance, they start by disagreeing, and by the end, they're agreeing with Socrates. And there was no argument. Socrates didn't say, fuck you, I don't like you, you're a piece of garbage. Instead, Socrates said, no, you don't understand, my friend. You're looking at it the wrong way. Look at it like this. Well, what do you think of this? Well, how about the error of this? And he brings their faults to their doorstep. And what's really key is he does not tell them their faults. No one wants to be told their faults, right? If he would say, no, you're wrong because of this. You're wrong because you do this. You're wrong because I don't like this. He's pushing their faults at them. He's throwing their faults upon them. Rather, he questions them and allows them to conclude in their own mind that the way they are thinking is faulty, right? So he says, well, again, with the sword analogy that we just heard previously, instead of telling the guy, oh, well, you don't give a sword to a crazy person, they'll kill you with it. You're telling him how to think, right? Therefore, he's less likely to want to hear it out because that means he would have to have full faith in your words and your thoughts. Not many have that. Not many have trust in others' thoughts and words. Therefore, he reframes and says, well, my friend, do you think that you would give a sword to a crazy man and expect him would you give a sword to a crazy man, right? Then the person now has to think themselves and come up with their own answer, right? You are now frameworking it in a way where it's their thought that makes the decision, not yours. So they'll say, no, I wouldn't. I don't want to get hurt by the crazy guy if I give him that sword, right? But if you tell him that, You are saying, I have authority, I know what's best for you, think about it like that. But if you question it upon him, you're leaving it for his interpretation. He now makes that decision, makes that authoritative choice, and comes to the conclusion on his own behalf. Socrates also does this in one of my favorite dialogues. It's called The First Alcibiades. In this dialogue, he goes back and forth with a friend and the guy says, you know, Socrates, you're imposing your thoughts upon me. And he says, oh, how have I imposed my thoughts upon you? And the guy says, well, you keep pushing arguments my way. And he says, no, rather, I all I've done is bridge you questions. You're answering my questions. And then he asks him another question. Again, he could say, since you're answering my questions, you're the one that's speaking, right? You're the one that's making the choices. Instead, he yet again questions farther to allow him to make the decisions. He says, if I question you and you give me an answer, who would be the speaker? The one questioning or the one answering? Well, there's only one logical answer to that. So his counterpart replies and states, well, obviously the one speaking would be the one answering would be the speaker. It wouldn't make sense the other way around. So Socrates says, well, therefore, I haven't made any decisions. You've made all the decisions. I've done nothing but ask questions. So he's actually manipulated this man into self-betterment by allowing the guy to study himself. It's a magnificent intellectual way of having these conversations. And it's something we have to learn to master ourselves. Rhetoric is very important. And if we can do that, we can have this back and forth and actually teach people how to think better without burning the bridge between us, right? Again, we have so many times in this movement where, and it's a very hard thing to master, but a lot of people in our movement will come to this this impasse when somebody comes to you and says, I think like this, or I think like this, or I think you're this. And instead of questioning them upon why they think this way, right, and going on a genuine inquiry and testing their logic so that they must test themselves in their conclusions, we just attack. And we say, no, you're wrong. because maybe I do know that they're wrong, right? So if a guy came in my chat and said, you're a Jew fed, I could go, you're wrong, fuck you, faggot, and ban him out of my chat room. Now, who's the good man? Neither. He's slandering me, and I'm not trying to help him. I'm actually doing the opposite, right? Now, if he comes in my chat and says, you're a Jew fed, and I know I'm not a Jew fed, instead of pushing that on him, and I say, what brings you to that conclusion? I'm curious. And he answers and says, well, the way your nose looks. And I can say, well, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. I can give you my genetic background if you're interested in that. In what way does my nose look Jewish, right? And you keep questioning. You keep questioning. You force them to provide the logical explanation. And when they get to the impasse where they run out of logical explanations, it is now proven that they are incorrect in their thoughts, and they must feel that upon themselves. And you'll see, you'll get a far different reaction out of those people than if you were to attack them and say, no, you're wrong. Try it. Attempt it. It's very difficult. It's something you have to learn to master. But I promise you, you will see, through a dialogue as such, you will get a far different reaction from the person who just attacked you. I've seen it myself quite a few times. It's important not to go straight to conflict or even straight to accusation, which is what the person, even if the person is accusing you first, don't accuse them back. Question them in their accusation and try to dig to the surface of their reasoning. And they'll more times than not find that they had no reasoning, and therefore they won't do it again because they are now embarrassed by the fact that they can't even back their own thought. It creates this embarrassment and this shame within them, and now they refuse to do this again. You've actually stopped the behavior in one fell swoop by just simply questioning the person.
Socrates' conception of benefit is tied up with his conception of virtue. Since virtue is knowledge for Socrates, the benefit that you owe to those who like you and to those who don't like you, the benefit that you owe to all men, is education. So the point of Socratic interaction, of Socratic dialogue, is the improvement of the people he's speaking to through this dialectical education, and that Socrates will do this both to people that consider themselves friendly and to people that consider themselves enemies. The best example.
Let's give another example. This is a really big one, especially when we're saying enemies, right? Because within our movement, we don't want to consider ourselves enemies, even if we have disagreements, right? So when we discuss with a communist, for example, a lot of people would just go, "Oh, shut the fuck up, you stupid commie! I don't want to hear your shit. I can't believe you believe that nonsense." Well, maybe they're wrong. Maybe they're lost. Maybe they don't understand, right? I mean, let's look at this on a fundamental basis. Communists, although their pathway is entirely incorrect and it's extremely flawed, these people genuinely want a betterment of society. Their version of betterment is not at all synonymous with ours. However, they want what's best. They just don't know how to get there. So our job should be not to attack them, not to create enemies of them, but rather uplift and educate them, right? This is what Hitler did directly, right? He converted many communists. But by telling them, look, you're being duped, right? And this comes through that Socratic method, that questioning. Holokov with another 25 library coins, he says, I've used Socratic method to argue with police. Very effective to answer a question with a question. The master asks the questions, the servant the answers. Very good. Can we get some Romans in the chat for Holokov? Thank you very much. Greatly appreciate that, my friend. And good point. Very good point. You're right. Especially that last line. The master asks the questions, the servant answers. Yes. The person who is authoritative in the conversation does the questioning, right? This is why I'll give you another really good example. You ever watch a news interview? BBC, CNN, right? They'll put these guys on. For instance, we've watched this before. Tom Brady, he's interviewed the KKK guy, and he had Pat Buchanan on the other side to just demean this KKK fella, right? Well, the KKK guy, they'll ask him a question, he answers the question. Then they ask him a question that is loaded with backwards precepts, and it puts him in the situation where he has to defend himself, right? And if you don't have all of the logical information, all the understanding, in order to just give a logical answer and a reasonable, well, this is why I think this way. Well, this is why racism is a positive and beneficial thing, right? If you don't answer these questions in a very springy and quick manner with a witty intellect, they make you look stupid. And that's why an interviewer will never, if you look at these interviewers that do these things, they'll never actually put their own opinion forward. They question you, right? So instead of making their opinion, let's give an example here. If they think racism is bad, right? The interviewer never tells the interviewee, well, racism is awful. It's terrible. Racism is a terrible thing. Instead, they go, how could you be so racist? They question you, and now it gives them that authority, and you now have to back yourself off onto the authority. Well, if you were a good interviewee, you would question them back and say, well, what good things has racism done for society? Now they're forced to bring back a point, right? An interview can go both ways, but they like to frame interviews as if you sit, you take the questions, and you fucking do it, right? Well, you can question back, and this is something people, when they're getting interviewed, have to become a master of as well. Continue here.
Example would be Thrasymachus. Thrasymachus thinks of himself as being Socrates' antagonist, but all through the dialogue, Socrates, when he refers to Thrasymachus, says, look, Thrasymachus and I have just become friends, but we were never enemies. The good man has no enemies. The good man is exclusively devoted to the idea of improving all fellow human beings. All right, that'll link up with Socrates' idea of piety. Piety, real piety, is service to the god by improving your fellow man.
And again, the only example I will give of this that I think is unfortunately incongruent, it's proven incongruent too many times now, is helping our fellow man being that of the Jew. They are not our fellow man. They're a foreign element to us. It does not benefit us or do us any good to try to uplift these people. They are a foreign entity. It is their duty to uplift themselves on their own accord. Otherwise, we end up putting ourselves through harm. I don't need to give much more of an example than Jesus Christ.
All right, so what he's going to try and show Polemarchus is that the good man does no one any harm. All right, there are many sort of Christian overtones to this, but I think that Socrates does it not because of some sort of mystical obligation, but because he's convinced that to be just means to wish justice and thus improvement and thus benefits to everyone in the world. Being just is what makes a man truly a social animal. Being completely unjust pulls you out of society, makes you an animal that's asocial. Socrates, in some ways, is the most social of animals, the most social of men, because he understands that he has universal moral obligations, educational obligations to everyone.
So again, this is specifically justice amongst the society, right? So what you have to understand, because this is something that most people don't recognize, this idea of treating all men as equal, okay? This means specifically your kinsmen, your fellow man, right? Foreign peoples are not your kinsmen, right? This is like, let's look at a school of fish, for example, or a society of fish, so to speak. Okay, we have all these fish in the ocean floating, swimming around, right? Well, a goldfish could try its absolute best to treat its fellow fish, the piranha, as best as it can and be very kind to Mr. Piranha, but that is always going to come to bite Mr. Goldfish in the ass every single time without exception, okay? So you have to understand that this idea of helping your fellow man, it's specifically your kinsman, okay? Modern society, the reason that this idea of helping your fellow man is so far subverted is because most of the people living among you or around you are not actually your fellow man anymore. They're not your kinsmen, okay? They're foreigners from a foreign land who don't hold the same moral concepts as you do. They do not hold the same theological ideals that you do. They don't even have the same cultural background as you. Therefore, they are not of you, right? So to help them, is again, it's synonymous to a goldfish helping a piranha. Okay, sure, they're both fish, but they're of a different kind. And because of that, that piranha, no matter how many times that goldfish tries to help, will always eat the goldfish. It doesn't matter how much the goldfish tries to say, preach peace and say, equality among all fish, Mr. Piranha, you don't have to eat us. There's plenty of coral in the sea, right? It's nonsense, okay? It's not going to actually lead anywhere. It's going to lead to your own extinction, your own death. You're harming yourself. No, it's not too late. Welcome, brother. Thank you. I'm happy to hear you read The Republic. It's a great book. All right, we're going to continue through here.
an example of what he's doing, or the kind of obligation he has, is his benefit of Polemarchus in this argument. Right? He takes this young kid that thinks he knows what justice is and says, look, son, first of all, the things you think are completely insufficient. Not only are they insufficient, but you know, I no longer want you to appeal to authority. From now on, I just want you to think on your own. I want to hear less quotes and more thinking that comes directly from you. And when you and I work through the argument, we will find that what I'm doing to you now, improving you morally by teaching you something, that's what you owe to all men. Right? That's giving what is owed, because that's what's truly, that's your true obligation. Well, after this kind of universal benefit, this argument that the good man does no one any harm, gets established, Thrasymachus, the key figure in this argument, makes his approach, makes his attack. Now, Thrasymachus all through is compared to an animal, to a wild animal, to a wolf, to a lion. The idea is that Thrasymachus, first of all, is an antisocial individual. He is the sophist. He is the tyrannical man. He is the man that thinks that desire is a good thing, and the more you gratify your desires, the better off you are. All right? He is the spiritual antipode of Socrates, and Socrates is going to be kind of a philosophical lion tamer. Socrates is going to go after his argument, and if not completely refuted, because the arguments that he uses are fishy, right, he will do sufficient damage to the argument, or he will call the argument into question sufficiently to silence Thrasymachus. That's the secret of Thrasymachus and all the sophists. They're ultimately nihilistic, I think, and nihilism ultimately collapses back down into silence. You don't refute a sophist, you quiet them down. And by reducing them to the silence from which they came, that's the best you're likely to do with a sophist. There's one or two exceptions to that rule, but that pretty much is the way it works. This pure power politics, this pure ego gratification, is ultimately nihilistic. Me, me, me. And what you do is you collapse that down, because solipsism, the drive towards individual gratification and towards individual satisfaction, is not only antisocial, but it tends to make language break down as well. As Wittgenstein pointed out to us, language is intrinsically a social enterprise. And it's something we share, it's something we have in common. When you try and isolate yourself, both morally and politically and linguistically, the result is silence, a collapse of discourse. That's why they prefer rhetoric and long speeches to dialectic. Sophists never want to get involved with dialectic. There's too much give and take. There's too much community. These tyrannical men are in opposition to community, both linguistic and political. So Socrates says, well, Thrasymachus, I don't mean to play games with you. I mean, if you didn't like my criticism of Polemarchus, I mean, please, we'd be happy to have you explain it to us. And he says, no. I'm going to pin you down this time, Socrates. You give me an answer. You tell us all directly what justice is. And don't tell me that it's the needful or the helpful or the advantageous or the useful or any of that sort of thing. Give me some specific, concrete thing that justice is. Now, first of all, this tells us a lot about Thrasymachus. He's a concrete, specific kind of a guy. He doesn't like these airy, Platonic abstractions. That's the realm in which the sophists never deal very well. Very rarely, with the exception of somebody like Hippias, do you see sophists talking about mathematics. They like tables and chairs, they like political power, they like the gratification of immediate desire. So Thrasymachus says, look, don't tell me it's useful, needful, advantageous, any of that stuff. And Socrates says, well, look, I can't answer you. I mean, you're a lot smarter than I am. You know a great deal more than I do. This is the favorite Socratic move of taking a step back, right, and then say, bring it on, right? There's a saying that fools rush in. Socrates teaches us that you don't rush right into an argument and tell people what you think. You're much more likely to sustain your argument if you retreat a little bit, think about what you're trying to say, and then go for the block rather than attacking directly. It's much easier to defend than attack. So when Thrasymachus makes his attack, and Thrasymachus thinks of rhetoric, thinks of verbal interaction as being something like a Homeric battle, right? He's been nurtured on Homer, and as a result, he wants to do something heroic, whereas Socrates also wants to do something heroic, but it's a different conception of heroism. All right? So Thrasymachus is a tyrannical man. He thinks tyranny is a good thing. He thinks gratifying desires is a good thing, and he wants to speak, but first he wants to have Socrates speak so he can go after Socrates, so he can pick it apart. Socrates takes the posture of irony, says, well, I really am not competent or capable. You're wise, Thrasymachus. And he really starts to lay the irony on pretty thick. He says, well, you best of men know far better than I do, and you understand these things far greater than most men, and all that sort of stuff. And what Thrasymachus does is very interesting. He says, look, Socrates, suppose I can give you a better answer about justice than you've been giving to anybody. What do you think you deserve to suffer? suffer. I mean, Socrates doesn't make anybody suffer, except when he makes them squirm under dialectical inquiry. He says, well, I should suffer what any man that's ignorant should suffer. I should suffer the pain of learning. All right, again, ironic, because that benefits you, doesn't make you suffer. And Thrasymachus says, yeah, I mean, sure, you should suffer the pain of learning, but pay a fine in money, too. This is very important. The sophists speak for their own benefit. Socrates speaks for the benefit of the people who are listening to him. Socrates never takes money for an argument. Socrates doesn't charge for it. Thrasymachus does it because he wants reputation, but also because he wants to make a few dollars, so, or whatever it is, coins that they had then. So Socrates says, well, I'll tell you what, if you show me a better argument about justice than I have, I'll pay you money when I get some. Now, of course, that's doubly ironic, because Socrates has never had a job that paid in his life. Socrates is, extremely poor, and he's never going to have any money, because he's never going to make any money, because he's never going to charge anybody for the wisdom that he kicks out. So Thrasymachus says, you know, that's not what I came here for, and Glaucon steps up, because Glaucon, as they say, is most brave in all things, a very courageous man, a little bit impetuous. But Glaucon steps up and he says, look, he has some money. I'm a rich guy, and I and my friends will put up some money for Socrates. Now, Thrasymachus, for the sake of money, speak. And for some money talks, and so does Thrasymachus. Thrasymachus says, okay, here's the answer. Justice is the advantage of the stronger. And he claps for himself, I guess. And this is clearly taken from something like, it's in the same intellectual tradition as something like Thucydides. Right? You remember the Melian dialogue? Any of the power politics that happened or that are found in Greece during the age of the Peloponnesian War. The idea is that politics and morality are completely separate, completely different. Morality has no application to politics. There's only winners and losers in politics. In some ways, Thrasymachus's argument that justice is the advantage of the stronger is a prefiguration of the kind of political stance that will be taken by Machiavelli or Nietzsche, or in some ways, in a more attenuated way, Hobbes. The idea being that the political world is a subset of the physical world, and it knows no moral law. All right, this is going to be exactly the opposite of the argument that Socrates is going to make throughout the Republic, where politics is ethics writ large. Well, if for Thrasymachus, it's not that there's no connection at all between politics and ethics. Politics is purely amount of question of power and getting control of the state. So justice is the advantage of the stronger. Thrasymachus is the spokesman for the status quo. All the cities that empirically exist in Greece have a regime that makes the laws. And for Thrasymachus, justice is the same thing as legality. It's something close to being like legal positivism, right? You make a law, that's what justice is. You obey the law. And every city makes different laws, and all the different cities that make different laws are making different kinds of justice, because it's strictly a power relationship. So Thrasymachus says, justice is the advantage of the stronger. Whoever's running the city, justice is doing what you tell them, or what they tell you. Now, he wants to walk away after that, and he wants some praise, and he wants some money. But Socrates says, well, stay a while and explain this to us. You know, now you have to submit to dialectical inquiry. I'm going to take this apart and have a look at it so we can all understand it better. And the first thing he says is, well, suppose, hypothetically, that the people that rule a city don't know what their interests really are. Which happens all the time. People make mistakes about who their friends and who their foes are. They make mistakes about what's good for them and what isn't. Suppose they lack that knowledge of what's really good for them. So, legislating in what they think is their interest, they legislate against their own interest. What happens then? Thrasymachus is, there's a little colloquy then between...
And this is symbolic, again, of your average modern-day liberal, for example, your average white liberal, who are, voting things into place that put foreigners into our lands... give foreigners power over top of us. People that actually advocate, white liberals who actually advocate for reparations, right? They're literally legislating against their own interests. They're putting the interests of others above their own, funnily enough, under the guise of equality, right? So equality doesn't work like that. Equality is you're equal or you're not. You don't... Well, they were more equal back. We were more equal back then. Therefore, we should give them more now, and that would kind of even it. That's not how equality works, okay? Because then you're creating more injustice in order to provide justice. It makes no sense, right? So, equality does not work on that plane. This is a huge problem we have in liberal modern society. They are against their own interests, and they'll do anything in order to perpetuate the interests of others.
Between Polemarchus and Cleitophon. Now, Cleitophon isn't going to come back in. Remember, there are 11 people in Cephalus's house at the time. Only six of them talk, and actually only two of them, Glaucon and Adeimantus, are the real important interlocutors with Socrates in this dialogue. But there's a small colloquy here at that point between Cleitophon and Polemarchus trying to support their favorite heroes. In other words, Polemarchus has been made a Socratic. Just in that earlier discussion. He says, you know, Socrates is a smart guy. I'm able to learn something from him. I'm going to support his half of the argument. I'm going to lend a little hand there. Cleitophon is a hanger-on of Thrasymachus, and they have a little colloquy there. Important later on, Polemarchus will be admitted into the argument just once at the beginning of Book 5, and Cleitophon will never be allowed to talk again. Right? And there's a reason for that. I'll try and explain what that reason is. But the point is, it's a little colloquy, and then Thrasymachus resumes the argument. What Thrasymachus says is this. It's not the case that when a person or a group of people are legislating for the city and for themselves, if they don't know what their good is, if they don't know what's really in their interest, well, then I don't mean those people are true legislators. The true legislator is the man or group of men that knows what his interests are and legislates in those interests. In other words, it's a funny sort of a move that Thrasymachus makes here. He's moving from a description of the way in which cities actually work, and he's moving from that descriptive treatment to a normative treatment. In other words, every city, every legislator ought to legislate in their true interest, and if they don't, well, then they're not the real legislator. And obviously, he's pulling a page out of Socrates' book here. The real doctor is the one who knows how to cure. The real shoemaker is the one who knows how to make shoes. And apparently, Thrasymachus is now trying to take this empirical, descriptive idea and make it normative. The real legislator for Thrasymachus is the person that knows their interest and legislates them to get what they want. Now, Socrates is going to give this a hard time. He says a couple of things here. First, he says, well, does any kind of art, any kind of, in this case, and what we mean by art here, the translation of art is techne, which involves crafts and arts, all those activities that work according to certain rules or principles that are governed by rules. You would juxtapose art, techne, to things like poetry, where who knows how a poet gets his inspiration, whereas you can explain to someone how to make shoes or how to be a doctor. So here we're going to talk about the art of politics, and we're going to connect politics with the other kind of technes, those rule-governed activities. Okay. So he says, is the political art that kind of art? Apparently it is. And here's a funny thing. In every case, the art that governs a particular domain, in the way that medicine governs the domain of bodies, sick or healthy bodies, and in the same way that shoemaking governs shoes, either, which happens all the time. People make, you know, not yet made. Any given art is interested in the domain of its art, not in the good of the artist. In other words, as a doctor, a physician is someone that heals bodies, not someone that takes care of himself, that makes money. As a shoemaker, a cobbler is someone that makes shoes, not someone that takes care of himself. As a shepherd, all right, a shepherd is concerned with the good of his flock, not with his own benefit. So Socrates makes the argument that in every case, any techne is concerned with the benefit of its object or subject, not the person that is... not the technician. Well, Thrasymachus says, well, then Thrasymachus, when he gradually gets reduced to silence, goes ad hominem. You'll find that in almost all the dialogues, when a sophist doesn't get his way, when a sophist doesn't like the tendency of an argument, they do one of two things. They shut up and they get real petulant. In other words, they begin to behave like spoiled five-year-olds. Right, they won't talk to you. And then the next thing that happens, if they start to lose face, because again, these men are very concerned with their status, they're not going to get money for being great speakers if Socrates makes them look foolish. So they either become quiet and withdrawn, or they become petulant and spoiled. Thrasymachus does both. He says, Socrates, do you have a wet nurse? She should wipe your nose. Now, this is not done in the best circles. In other words, the great Platonic interlocutors never go ad hominem against Socrates because, well, it lacks taste as well as kind of intellectual strength. And Socrates says, well, what are you talking about? What do you mean? He says, well, look, don't tell me that the shepherd supervises the sheep in the interest of the sheep. He supervises the sheep because he's interested in consuming lamb chops. So he does it for his own benefit. Don't tell me that you're going to get this, that the techne supervises the thing that it applies to. In fact, every techne serves the interest of the technician and only the technician. As long as the doctor gets paid, it doesn't make any difference whether he cures bodies or not, is the idea. And Socrates thinks about that for a second. He says, well, please, Thrasymachus, don't go away like the bath man yet. In Athens, when you took a bath, someone would pour in warm water in and then walk away. Thrasymachus was walking away like a bath man. Socrates says, hold on for a second now. Come back and let's have a look at that. Let's think about that argument. He says, I need to know something. You say that the unjust man tries to get the better of everybody. Is that the case? And that's what makes him such a great kind of heroic sort of a figure. In some ways, he's like the figures in the Homeric poetry. Well, this unjust man that's wise and smart and capable, he has something like Machiavellian virtù. All right. Well, this unjust man, he tries to get the better of his opposite, which is the just man, and he tries to get the better of all the other unjust men in the world. In other words, he tries to make himself king of the hill. Is that the case, Thrasymachus? Thrasymachus says, yes, of course that's the case. He wants to get all the good things for himself. He wants to have lots and lots of desires and satisfy them as much as he can. He wants to be something like, I guess, Achilles, you know, any of the great Homeric heroes. Well, he says, think about this, Thrasymachus. Everyone who really is knowledgeable about an art, that really understands some sort of techne, do they want to get the better of everybody, or do they just want to get the better of people who don't know what's going on? Thrasymachus doesn't immediately catch on, because it's not an obvious argument. He says, well, think of it this way. For a person that doesn't know a techne, aren't they the ones that want to get the better of everybody? Whereas a person that really thoroughly knows a techne only wants to get the better of people who are different, who don't know what they're doing, rather than those who do. Let me give you a concrete example, make it a little more obvious. Imagine a doctor, cardiologist, knows all about hearts. Now, if someone has a heart attack and a real cardiologist goes up and starts doing the appropriate medical thing to him, well then suppose a second cardiologist walks in and sees that the guy's had a heart attack and sees that the cardiologist is doing something good for him. A cardiologist in this case is a man who knows the techne, the medicine of hearts. Well, the second cardiologist says, well, no, that's the right procedure. That's the right treatment. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to get the better of him. Say, get off him. I'm going to do the right cardiac thing. As long as both doctors really understand this techne, really understand doctoring, well, then the second physician doesn't want to get the better of the first. Now, consider a second circumstance. Someone has a heart attack, and a quack doctor comes in first and starts some procedure that's completely inappropriate to someone that has a heart attack because he's a quack doctor, doesn't know anything. Now, our cardiologist comes in again, has a look at what's going on here, and says, get away from him, you're going to kill this guy, he's having a heart attack, and here you are doing some ridiculous procedure that has nothing to do with the knowledge of medicine. What this means, or that what I'm taking this as an instantiation of, is the idea that the true knower, the true technician, or the true craftsman, artist, something like that, in this case, the art of doctoring, doesn't want to get the better of people that know doctoring. They say, look, he's a real doctor, he knows his business, he's handling this right, I don't have to do anything. But he certainly wants to get the better of the quack doctor because he's going to harm the patient. And remember, this doctor who has, the second one who has the techne, is interested in the benefit of the patient. Right? So now, we make this analogy, move from the doctor's art to the political art. Does the real politician, does he want to rule? Suppose he comes to a city that's well-run, that has a real lawful king who has real political knowledge and is running the city very well. Does he want to usurp that power? No, in the same way that the doctor doesn't want to take over from the other doctor, he's doing just fine. On the other hand, when a city is badly run by people that don't have political knowledge, that make foolish laws or foolish decisions, and a real politically knowledgeable person comes in, a political philosopher comes in, does he want to get the better of that city? Yes. That's analogous to the case of the quack doctor. So in every case, Socrates makes the argument that the knower only wants to get the better of the ignorant.
Okay, we're gonna finish his speech there. There's a couple minutes left, but we have to end at 7 o'clock since we're on Speak Free Radio today, so I want to make sure I have time to do a little bit of an outro and kind of just remind everybody what's going on for the rest of the week. I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. It was a more relaxed, you know, philosophical kind of a show discussing different concepts. And for those who aren't familiar with the guy we just were listening to, his name is Michael Sugru. Brilliant philosopher. It's a very deep shame. We unfortunately lost him about a month ago. He passed away, so here's a link in the chat room to this specific video. You'll be able to find all of his other videos on the channel that is posted on. He also has a podcast up on Spotify in which he did a lot of philosophical discussions with his actual daughter. Very brilliant man, spoke very well and had a very good understanding of a lot of these books. Christos with the $5 investment. He says, always enjoy philosophy. Thank you very much, my friend. Can we get some Romans in the chat for Christos? Thank you. I really appreciate the support, my friend. And I'm glad you enjoy philosophy, because so do I. I think it's of the utmost importance, and especially with what we're going through today. Mariner as well with another $5. He says, hail victory. Let's get the Romans up in the chat for both of those fellas. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you, Mariner. Hope you enjoyed that. I'm surprised you didn't know about Michael. I think you'll definitely like his stuff. He's got some very intellectual work. He's a great thinker, truly. I don't think he wrote any of his own things. However, if he did, I certainly want to find them and start reading them as well, because he had a good understanding of most of these philosophers. Anyways, today was the second stream on Speak Free Radio. We're going to be doing this every single Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern until 7 p.m. Eastern. Always, we're going to do it more of a audio podcast kind of a format rather than the video format, just because people on Speak Free Radio unfortunately don't have a visual, so I don't want to pressure them with, like, you know, or confuse them where I'm talking about things that they don't know what's going on. So I kept it to mostly audio. I think that would be a little bit better. Again, it's Michael Sugrue, and the link is in the chat. Interesting, Christos. I did not know that. Interesting. All right. Well, thank you guys again for watching. I'm glad that that everybody seemed to really enjoy the philosophical kind of a stream. Those are my personal favorite to do. I always find them the most entertaining for myself, just discussion-wise. So if you are on Speak Free Radio, don't forget to follow me on all of my other platforms. And if you want to contact me anywhere, you can do so on all these platforms. You can find me on Gab at Logos Revealed. You can find me on Odyssey at Logos Revealed. And Odyssey is O-D-Y-S-E-E. You can find me on Telegram at Logos Revealed. And if you want to speak to me personally, you can email me logosrevealed88@gmail.com. Okay. Thank you guys again for watching the show. I had a really good time discussing the stuff today, and I'll certainly be doing that again in the future. A little more of these philosophy streams. I think they're really beneficial, and something that we all should be somewhat tacking onto as best we can within this movement. Let's see here. Okay, so yeah, for the rest of the week, again, I'll be live tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern. We got Napalm coming on, and then I'll be live Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. And Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern with Tonitris, we're going to be doing a debate stream. Thank you again, folks, for watching. Again, if you want to support this show, help me out. This, again, goes to both people live and offline. You can also support offline as well for the guys who like to watch the replays. All the descriptions are in the chat below. We've got the crypto wallets. Entropy would be for live alerts. Obviously, if I'm not live, it won't be live alert, but you'll still be able to support that way. And then you can always support straight through Odyssey. And if you're offline, you can just do a little comment on the video with a support, a little support amount. Only a request is if you do support with the crypto wallets, please do me a favor and message me personally when you do so, so I make sure I don't miss it and I see it go through and I can thank you directly for it. I don't like to not be grateful for the things that come my way. So, alrighty, thank you guys so much for watching. We're actually going to outro the stream with some music, and we're going to get rolling for the night. I'll be live again tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern, okay? I'll see you guys then. Thank you guys so much for watching. I hope you guys have a wonderful night. I'll see you later.